Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Why thanking a veteran can get awkward. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. On Memorial Day, we remember the fallen, but a lot of people also go out of their way to thank veterans for their service. Some vets, though, say this just makes them feel uncomfortable, even angry.
However kind-hearted that thank you is, it's made without much interest in what they're thanking you for, which is killing people.
We'll get different perspectives on that. Also remembering a German U-boat attack off of New Orleans, plus a musician from New Zealand who likes to pretend like he's not.
I really get off on sounding like I'm from somewhere else or from some other time. It's quite freeing for me.
Those stories today here on The World. It's Memorial Day, and over the next hour, we'll be hearing some stories about vets and the cost of conflict. One story about vets painting and rug making to get past the trauma of war. And we'll hear about the big news and big change for a vet who was deported to Mexico. We actually start things off today in the war court at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Self-described 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, along with four co-defendants, appeared at a pretrial hearing about what can and cannot be used in their future trial. This is pretty granular legal stuff, but it's critical. At its heart, this pretrial hearing is a debate about torture. My WGBH colleague Arun Roth is in Guantanamo and was at the hearings this morning. He's just outside the courtroom.
This is all about looking past the trial itself and looking to the sentencing phase. They want to be able to have as much information on the record about the ill treatment of these men, their waterboarding and the abuse that they suffered, the torture at the hands of the CIA before they even arrived at Guantanamo. The idea being that when it comes to the sentencing phase, they will be able to admit this and have it count in some way towards the punishment for these men. The idea being that maybe they would be able to be spared the death penalty if the defense can argue that their ill treatment was so morally reprehensible that we have now lost the moral authority to be able to execute them.
Yeah, how likely is it that the U.S. government will entertain that side of the story?
I think very unlikely. I mean, I can't imagine that happening. Although, Mark, I would say this. I mean, there are five defendants here, and not all of them were as involved in the plot as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So it's possible maybe that one of these individuals might be able to be spared a life sentence and might be able to be spared execution in the end. But it's hard to imagine and hard to say still at this point.
So the man at the center of what will be a trial, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, what did he look like today and how did he respond to the proceedings?
He looked in very good health. Clearly, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is not hunger striking. He's got quite a belly on him. And his beard, we actually talked about this a few years ago when he started to stain it red to, I guess, show his devotion. It's gone to a full-on orange now. I'd even call it flamboyant.
Oh, wow. What's going to happen this week overall, and what's at stake with this hearing? As we said, what's essentially torture?
Interestingly, Marco, probably the most exciting, for lack of a better word, witness that we'll have this week involves abuses that allegedly are going on right now here in Guantanamo. One of the defendants, this is Ramzi bin al-Shib, he has been saying that he's been subjected to vibrations and noise in his cell in Guantanamo to torment him, basically, in a way that's kind of similar to the ways that the CIA used noise to sort of harass prisoners over time. The defense is going to call as a witness Abu Zubaydah, who is one of the highest value detainees at the prison. He was considered to be part of Osama bin Laden's inner circle. He's not been seen since 2002, and apparently he's been experiencing some of the same stuff, and we'll be called in to talk about that. And so we'll hear some testimony about the super top secret Camp 7, where the high-value detainees are being held.
So this is an important hearing, but in terms of the actual trial, much less some kind of verdict, that's also going to take time. What is the outside estimate?
Well, earlier this year, I saw an estimate of 2020. Last week, I saw somebody put it at 2025. Last night, Jim Harrington, who's one of the defense attorneys, said to me that the actual start of the trial gets farther and farther away each day. Like, the more they dig into this stuff, the harder it gets.
my WGBH colleague Arun Rath at pretrial hearings in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Thanks very much, Arun.
Thanks, Marco. Pleasure.
So expect a long wait before a trial and an even longer wait for a verdict. That's something that families from the African nation of Chad can certainly relate to. But this story of the trial of Chad's former dictator also suggests that justice can come eventually. We learned today that Chad's ex-ruler, Hissène Habré, has been found guilty of the murder and torture of tens of thousands of people while he was in power during the 1980s. The trial took place in Senegal, and it was an unprecedented case.
It's the first time anywhere in the world, not just in Africa, that the courts of one country have prosecuted the leader of another one for human rights crimes.
That's Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch. He's been working on this case for many years. I spoke with him via Skype from Senegal's capital, Dakar, and I asked him about the reaction from people in court today when the verdict came down.
Well, they were ululating and jubilating. You know, this is 25 years that they never gave up. And today was the reward for all of that struggle.
So, Reed, give us the background to this verdict and what it really means for these people who are in the courtroom in Dakar. What had Habré done to them and their families, and why?
One of the people in court today was Suleiman Gengeng, who was falsely accused of connection with the armed opposition. He was thrown in jail. As people were dying around him, Suleiman took an oath that if he ever got out, he would fight for justice. And he came out, founded the Victims Association, and started the fight for justice. When he was forced into exile by Habré's accomplices, who were still living in Chad, Clément Abaifuta took over the Victims Association. Clément, his job in prison was to bury other prisoners. Each day, he and others would go around the different prisons and load dead prisoners onto the back of trucks and dump them in a mass grave outside of the capital. Women testified who were victims of sexual slavery, sent to the desert north to serve in Hissène Habré's army, to serve the soldiers of Hissène Habré's army. One of the women testified that she was raped personally by Hissène Habré, and the court today found that her testimony was credible, that Habré had raped her. First time ever that a former head of state is convicted in international trial of actually having personally committed rape. So these are very serious crimes, and as you know, Habré got a life sentence for these crimes.
We're talking about events that go back to the 1980s. Habré was in power from 82 to 1990. When did you become part of the defense team? And I know you've represented other victims throughout the world, victims of other dictators. Why is this important to you?
Well, I was working on the case of the former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet, who was arrested in London in 1998 on charges from a Spanish judge for crimes allegedly committed in Chile. And when we were working on that case, the Chadians came to us and said, hey, we want to do that. We have our own Pinochet who's called Hissène Habré. Can you help the victims? Can you help us bring Hissène Habré to justice? And so I've been working with them for 17 years on the political aspects, the legal aspects. I happened to stumble at one point on the files of Hissène Habré's political police, the DDS, tens of thousands of regime documents that provided a roadmap to how Habré carried out the repression of the Chadian people, documents that give the names of 1,208 separate victims who died in detention, of almost 13,000 victims of torture and of arbitrary detention. So we've been working with them, helping them find a way, because we got Habré arrested here in Senegal 16 years ago, and the former president of Senegal basically gave us the runaround, what Bishop Desmond Tutu would call a political and legal soap opera, until finally a decision of the World Court in 2012 said that Senegal had a legal obligation to prosecute or extradite Hissène Habré. And the new president of Senegal, Macky Sall, said that he was going to organize this trial, that the road for justice opened up again for these victims.
That's Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch speaking about the guilty verdict today in the trial of Chad's former dictator, Hissène Habré. Let's go back more than 70 years now to World War II. German submarines, or U-boats, were patrolling off U.S. shores. Many people here don't realize it, but during the war, German U-boats sank about 50 ships in the Gulf of Mexico. One of those submarine attacks happened on May 19th, 1942, just about 40 miles from New Orleans. My WGBH colleague Elizabeth Ross has the story of a survivor.
Ray Downs vividly remembers his last night aboard the big old grey merchant ship Heredia. He was 8 years old, and for him and his 11-year-old sister, Lucille, it was a great adventure.
My sister and I asked our parents if we could sleep out on the deck because it was quite humid, and we had done that in other nights, and it was very nice. The breeze was out there. But since it was our last night on the ship, they said, no, we're going to sleep in our cabins.
Ray's family had been down in South and Central America. His father had been working as a mechanic with the United Fruit Company in Colombia and Costa Rica. The idea had been to make and save as much money as possible in a year. Now the family was heading home.
Just as we were going down to our cabins, the captain came up and he put his hand in my hair and shuffled my hair and said, well, sonny boy, about 6:30 in the morning, you'll be in New Orleans.
But in the middle of the night, while Ray was fast asleep, Heredia was hit by two torpedoes.
When the first explosion hit, dreaming, I thought the ship was banging against the pier in New Orleans. When the second torpedo hit, it woke me, and the next thing, my dad was standing there, and he said, put on your life preserver. You had a little peg that hung right by your bunk. But I looked down on the deck, and he was already standing in water about a calf high.
Heredia had been hit by a German submarine, U-506. Ray's family was the only family on the freighter. Ray, his father, mother, and sister all held hands and headed up the stairwell to the main deck.
Just as we were stepping out on the main deck, the ship rolled, and it washed us all apart. It washed my dad back down. It washed my sister around the other side of the ship, and it pinned my mother up against a stairwell. I went underwater, and I didn't think I was ever going to come up. Anyway, when I finally came up, I realized it was so light, and that's how I realized that the sub had surfaced and put floodlights on the sinking ship.
Ray escaped from the ship, clinging to a small balsa wood raft covered in canvas. For the next 18 hours, Ray, his father, another passenger and the ship's captain all drifted on the tiny raft in the endless ocean. Together they endured a blistering sun, circling sharks, hypothermia, hunger and thirst. But eventually a search plane found them and sent a signal to a nearby shrimp boat.
I never will forget this. We came on board and they were cooking shrimp jambalaya, and it smells so good.
Later, the same shrimp boat found Ray's mother, Ina. She was all alone, floating in the water and covered in oil from the sunken ship. Decades afterwards, Ina made a recording about her experience, in which she said it was her prayers that had saved her.
I said, dear Lord, please take care of me. And I could hear him just as plain, I will not leave.
Ina also prayed for her children. It was the ship's second mate who saved Lucille. Floating in the Gulf for hours, Lucille kept their spirits up by singing her mother's favorite hymn, Nearer, My God, to Thee. There were 62 people on board Heredia. 35 of them died. Ray's family lost everything they owned on the ship, but they never lost their will to survive. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Ross.
Coming up, warmer weather and Libya in crisis mean more boats filled with more refugees crossing the Mediterranean. It's here on The World. I'm Marco.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
Worman, and you're listening to The World on this Memorial Day. When people die in drownings, it's tragic. When they die with seasonal regularity, it's despicable. We know that thousands of people take to rickety boats from North Africa in the hope of making it to Europe. What's new now is a shocking number of them who are dying on that journey. The UN says it believes more than 700 people may have drowned in the Mediterranean just in the past week alone trying to reach Italy. 15,000 people were rescued. Christopher Catrambone is the founder of MOAS, the Migrant Offshore Aid Station. His organization goes out to rescue people trying to make that dangerous crossing. He joins me from Malta. 700 fatalities in 1 week. Christopher, why are the numbers so high right now?
Well, the crisis in Libya is continuing. And, of course, that you continue to have mass amounts of migration. So you have refugees, you have migrants, you have asylum seekers coming from oppressive regimes in Africa. So you really do have a emergent mixed migration that is converging on this lawless state of Libya. And human traffickers are making the best out of the situation by providing this passage in these rickety boats to Europe.
Is there one section of the Mediterranean that you and the Migrant Offshore Aid Station focus on specifically?
The central Mediterranean is the most prevalent problem that continues to happen, and it continues to get worse every year. In Greece, we saw this kind of turn on the faucet really quickly, the number of people that were moving in. But in the Mediterranean, it's been happening for 20 years, and I've got guys running our SAR operations that were seeing this 15 years ago. So this is not new. It is really a part of Libya's history.
The situation is not new, but the numbers are new, right? I mean, the people crossing, it's higher than ever. And it sounds like the last couple of weeks, the numbers of people drowning is really high.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're hearing reports out at sea that people are not even having enough deck space to put bodies on board. They're having to mark bodies with life jackets just so they can be picked up later. I mean, that's extremely disturbing.
I mean, Chris, the Migrant Offshore Aid Station is just one organization. What kind of other international help are you seeing?
The British sent ships in, the Irish, the German Navy, and, of course, the Italians stepped up their effort as well. And there have been more organizations that have been sea-based, but there are organizations that are starting as well in Libya. For example, you'll see the Libya Red Crescent. The extent of their operations is basically scavenging the coast to pick up bodies that are washing up ashore. And I think that is something that is extremely alarming. What we don't know is how many people are dying in this so-called dead zone within the Libyan territorial waters. We don't know how many deaths are happening on a daily basis.
Christopher, you started MOAS, I believe, after your own eyes were open to the refugee crisis and the drownings in the Mediterranean in 2013 when you were on vacation in the Mediterranean. Did you think you'd still be doing this work now in 2016?
When we started doing this, we said, okay, you know, let's go and save people out at sea. People are drowning. Let's go pull them from the water. This is humanity. We need to save people. And now we're looking 3 years later. We're launching our biggest mission yet. We've got two very big ships. We've got a pair of the most advanced drones in the world. So we're mounting our biggest response yet. And it doesn't seem to be getting any better. And I don't think that even stabilizing Libya, you're not answering the root cause of these problems. People want to seek shelter and the safety of Europe, and they are willing to die making this crossing to seek that safety.
Christopher Catrambone, the founder of MOAS, the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
The other main path to Europe, of course, is in the eastern Mediterranean, where for many months large numbers of refugees and migrants found their way from Turkey to the Greek island of Lesbos. Those numbers have since gone down. Many of the travelers stayed on Lesbos much longer than they expected. They've had to make do with the limited resources available on the island. Catherine Whitaker visited the Moria camp on Lesbos in January. She's trying to get a sense of the role that limited food plays in creating a sense of community in the camp. When Catherine was there, volunteers and refugees were able to gather at a place where they could talk over a warm cup of tea.
Before I even saw it, I could smell it. There was cinnamon and ginger, and it was very strong, and it smelled very homey. It was very welcoming. And on the inside, there are a series of benches, and they have these big vats of tea. And the volunteers sit on the benches, and the refugees come to a little opening in the front of the tent, and the volunteers hand tea through this opening. The tea tent is next to some clothing distribution areas where people can get changed, and it's sort of a natural progression. They come in wet, usually, because they just came off the boats and they've been through quite a bit of water. And so then they come to the clothing distribution tent and they dry off or they receive new clothes. They change and they're dry and then they want to be warm. And so not only does the tea sort of fulfill that purpose, but it's a good way to sort of see more of the camp. It's right there in the middle of everything. So it's sort of a natural progression to go there. In the tent, there are a number of volunteers, and they're from all different places. A number of volunteers from the U.S., there were some from Germany, Switzerland, and France. There were some volunteers that were permanently stationed inside this tent, and they were the ones responsible for making the tea. And that was a pretty serious job. I didn't realize this until after I had left, and I was speaking with the coordinator of the tea tent. But they have specific recipes that they use. So a big part of their job is to get that all together in these huge vats. And the refugees came from all backgrounds. And one of the really amazing things as you walk by is you can hear such a mix of languages. And even if you don't understand exactly what they're saying, you can tell that they're from different cultures and they're coming to this tent as sort of a community. So there were refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Morocco, and different countries in Africa. And they all ended up here. And there were refugees actually volunteering in the tent. And one refugee that I can think of in particular, he was from Morocco. And he was at the time considered an economic refugee. And of course, this distinction has changed quite a bit since I have gotten back. I'm sure now it's quite different. But when he was there, he was not allowed to leave Lesbos. Or he could have, I suppose, gone to Athens, but he would have been sent back. So he was there long term, and he had been working in the tea tent, and everyone knew who he was, and he was very good at what he did, and he sort of ran things in there. But he also used the tea tent as a way of finding out more about Germany, because like many refugees, that was where he wanted to go. And he had a little smartphone, and he would listen to music. It was German music, but it was not contemporary music. So he was listening to these sort of traditional German songs, and he would ask people about German culture. When there were volunteers from Germany, he made a point of saying, "What should I know when I go to this country?" And most of the English he knew, he had picked up at this refugee camp. So the tea tent was, for him, as much of a networking space as anything, and he had sort of a family to lean on.
Catherine Whitaker is assistant digital editor for Saveur magazine. She visited the Moria refugee camp on Lesbos in January. In March, the refugee camp became a holding center for migrants, and the tea tent was shut down. We still have the photos, though, at PRI.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Arizona Democrat Ruben Gallego wants to change U.S. law to help deported veterans.
The only right they get to keep is the right to get buried in U.S. cemeteries, and that's the only time they're ever allowed back in the United States. And it's just unfathomable that we could do this to any veteran.
That story coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 1.2 million. That's how many Americans have died fighting in all U.S. wars combined. A sobering and somber number, 1.2 million. Memorial Day is a time to remember the dead, but it doesn't only have to be somber, says John Noggle. He's a retired Army officer who served in Iraq, and he lost friends in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I can't think of any better way to celebrate them than to throw a burger on the grill next to the pool, be with friends, and tell some stories about them and remember them. And certainly that's what I would want them to do if the bullet had found me instead of found them.
And so what about that impulse to walk up to veterans and say, thank you for your service? The World's Matthew Bell reports that thank you doesn't always sit right. My kids' elementary school outside of Boston holds its annual Memorial Day event the week before the Monday holiday, and it's a great big red, white, and blue extravaganza. Amid a sea of American flags, the kids sang the anthems for all five branches of the U.S. Armed Forces. Two veterans in dress uniforms spoke about the meaning of Memorial Day. The school principal stood up and said, "Thank you for your service." It's something that vets hear a lot on the last Monday of May.
When I was a kid growing up in the 50s, my recollection of Memorial Day was that it was simply a holiday. It was a day for a cookout.
Andrew Basevich was a first lieutenant with the U.S. Army in Vietnam. He's the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East. He says thanking vets for their service on days like today is about making up for the fact that some Americans treated Vietnam vets with disrespect.
I think that there is a widespread conviction, deepened by the events subsequent to 9/11, that the American people should never again fall short in expressing their appreciation for the wartime service of veterans.
Yet, for some veterans, hearing "thank you for your service" makes them feel uncomfortable at best. Tim O'Brien is a writer and a Vietnam vet, and he says he has a visceral reaction when random people come up and say that.
I react with anger, essentially. However kind-hearted that thank you is, it's made without much interest in what they're thanking you for, which is killing people. And even if one doesn't personally do it, you're part of something that's the whole purpose, the function of it all.
Only about 7% of Americans have ever served in the military. That means most of us have no firsthand experience of what military service or war really means.
The bodies are hidden from us. The anguish is hidden away from us, even in the media. I feel there's a kind of hypocrisy in it. A thank you without much interest in what a person goes through fighting a war, the horrors of it all, what's witnessed and what's done, and how it hurts your soul years and years and decades later.
Iraq War veteran Phil Clay is the author of Redeployment, a collection of short stories about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He says thanks for your service can be a heartfelt expression of gratitude, but he says it can also be frustrating when it comes from someone who doesn't appear very engaged with how America's wars have played out.
I was a professional soldier in a professional military. I know what the mission was. I know what Iraq looks like right now. And it matters to me that Anbar province is not peaceful and secure. It matters to me, and there are consequences to that. There are consequences that we all as a country need to think about. And, you can't paper that over with a phrase.
Some vets are quick to point out that Memorial Day is not really about them. It's about those who made the ultimate sacrifice. Andrew Basevich, the retired Army officer, lost his son in Iraq. Andrew Jr. was killed while on patrol in 2007. Basevich says honoring the fallen on Memorial Day is important, but what's also important is reflecting on America's wars, what's been gained and what's been lost, and that means getting into the politics of it all.
War is about politics. It is saturated with politics. And I think to pretend otherwise is a grotesque error and, quite frankly, results in dishonoring the memory of those who have served and who have sacrificed.
For the World, I'm Matthew Bell.
That story really got us thinking here in the newsroom. We figured we could put some of the questions we had to you. What's Memorial Day about for you and your family? And what's the best way to thank our veterans? We're talking about this over on our Facebook page. Just look for The World. For many who served and returned, the memory of war is indelible, and it can remain for years after the war is over, especially for vets suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. Traditional forms of therapy may offer some relief, but other forms of psychotherapy are also being tried. A Veterans Administration center near Boston is piloting a creative expressions therapy program, and as Christina Quinn reports, it's proving so successful that the curriculum could be expanded nationwide.
The vets do art therapy in this basement studio. Anthony DeBaradinas is a Vietnam vet. He's part of a group called Happy Hookers.
Hookers. On our rugs. We hook rugs.
He and his latch-hooking gang of vets meet every week. He shows off his latest rug. It has two wolves on it howling at the moon.
I have done this. I have done four smaller ones. Without this, I know I would be back in the hospital. I'm hoping over a period of time, this will put me back to who I was and not what I am now.
The creative prompt for the day is who I was, who I am, and recovery through art. The therapy program is called Creative Expressions and is designed to help vets heal from their trauma with poetry, painting, or sculpture. Other groups play music or tell their stories through movement and dance.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for sharing those powerful words. And what
That's program founder Griselda Hogan talking to her vets. She says some of them didn't respond well at all to traditional forms of therapy, but they're thriving in this program. She noticed right from the beginning.
It felt very safe. It wasn't stigmatizing. And we learned more about them in, I think, 10 to 12 sessions than people who had been working with them for up to 12 years.
Part of the reason for that may be that vets helped develop the program from the start and now co-own it with the VA. It's been a lifesaver for Hyacinth Graves.
Well, I was attacked in the service. I was raped. And it manifests in several different ways.
Graves is an Army vet who came to the VA last fall to do an expressive therapy program specifically for women who experienced military sexual trauma. That's the official term. She was raped when she was in the service in the mid-80s and has been struggling with PTSD and substance abuse ever since.
Nobody really wanted to address it. They were like, what were you wearing? Were you drinking? You know, did you know these guys? Did you lead them on? And for me, that was the knife in the back for me.
Right.
I couldn't understand them not saying, you know, are you okay?
She was told to man up like the guys, but manning up only made things worse, and she continued to struggle after she completed her time in the service.
Severe depression, where I'd have to blacken the entire room to just be there. No sunlight, noise bothered me because of the sexual trauma. Interacting with men was very difficult. I couldn't, you know, hold a job. Because the slightest sight of a man near me, I'd go into extreme panic. There are the headaches, times when you just don't feel like eating.
The past three decades have been a long and challenging healing process. But Hyacinth saw a major turning point after she started painting in the VA's expressive therapy program.
Coming here, it was freer. You have the opportunity to stretch out and do things you never thought that you would do, like sketching for me. I mean, I draw stick people. But to do a landscape and to actually see that that was my hand and my mind that created that, mm-hmm. You know, it lets you know that you can. There are a lot of things that you can do. You can continue to grow. You can learn. Learning that I wasn't finished.
And that's precisely how expressive therapy works, according to Boston University psychiatry professor Bessel van der Kolk and author of the best-selling The Body Keeps the Score. He says when you have PTSD, your brain is stuck in a feedback loop of danger and helplessness.
The whole brain gets organized to detect danger and not to detect ordinary things. So life passes you by when you have PTSD. And so you don't live. You live inside of your trauma.
But he says expressive therapy can reactivate those parts of the brain that feel pleasure and control by opening up people's imaginations to new possibilities. You can't see your way to the future without imagination.
Sonny, what do you plan on doing? You're going to glue it onto like a cushion? Or?
Well, you buy a silk backing for it,
right?
And you sew it on and stuff it.
It sure sounds like these veterans are looking forward to the future. They're publishing a book of their artwork and writing, and Creative Expressions just got a grant from the VA Center for Innovation in Washington. Griselda Hogan says the money will allow them to expand this program into a wellness center and to collect data about what's working and what isn't. And all of this is hand-in-hand with the vets.
We don't do anything without their guidance, without their feedback, so they'll guide us to where they want to go.
All it takes is a little imagination. For The World, Christina Quinn, Boston.
We're going to look at another group of veterans now caught in a difficult situation. These are vets who, for whatever reason, have been deported to the countries they originally came from. Some are undocumented. Some were convicted of criminal offenses. We don't know exactly how many veterans the U.S. government has deported. I met several of them on assignment in Tijuana a couple of months ago, and in their own network, they've made contact with 70 around the world. Ruben Gallego, a Democratic congressman from Arizona, is co-sponsoring a bill to help some of these deported veterans.
I wrote the bill to do two things. One is to stop further deportation of veterans, because right now there is no protection for veterans should they commit any type of crime. And two, it would ask that the Homeland Security or whatever relevant department sets up a process so we could start bringing these veterans home.
I mean, you're a former Marine, served in Iraq. Is this personal? Do you know people who served and were deported?
I don't know anybody, but it is personal. It's personal because it's affecting fellow Marines and fellow veterans, and that's personal to me. And we just can't be doing this to people that have been willing to sacrifice their lives for their country. And unfortunately, many of them are being deported because of service-related issues. People, you know, that have PTSD and that are self-medicating themselves or hurting themselves, and then find themselves involved with the law. And next thing you know, they're getting kicked out of this country. And the only right they get to keep is the right to get buried in U.S. cemeteries, and that's the only time they're ever allowed back in the United States. And it's just unfathomable that we could do this to any veteran.
Right. Sure, there are extenuating circumstances like PTSD, but in a lot of cases, these vets committed crimes and they served their time. And when they got out, they were deported. Isn't that the way the system is supposed to work?
No, I don't think that's the way the system is supposed to work. If anything, it's you're punishing them twice. And obviously, they did their time. And if they did their time, then they should be allowed back into the country or into society without us having to deport them. We asked them to make the ultimate sacrifice. The least we could do is to make sure that we treat them like we would treat any other U.S. citizen and give them a chance to basically repair themselves, rehabilitate themselves, and integrate back into society.
One of the people I met in Tijuana a couple of months ago was a former Marine, Antonio Romo Reyes. He fell into drugs and crime while struggling with PTSD after deployment. And he seemed pretty much to accept that now that he's been deported, he'll need some miracle to be made a U.S. citizen. How would your bill help him?
Well, it just depends on the level of his crime. What it would do is it would allow him to petition to come back into the United States. And he would come back, but not as a U.S. citizen. He would come back under a different status, probably as an LPR, which probably what he was before, the legal permanent resident. And eventually, through the normal process, he would become a citizen. But first, we have to get him back in the United States. Citizenship is not at all answered within this bill. I have other bills that talk about this, but this is just to get these men and women back home.
If you have a vet who's not a U.S. citizen and serves, returns home, and then commits a crime, under the bill you've co-sponsored, would deportation hereafter be waived?
It depends on your level of crime, but for serious felonies, no, such as murder, rape, things of that nature. But for misdemeanors and minor misdemeanors, they would not be eligible for deportation. So, for example, DUIs, drug possession, things of that nature.
Do you think for some lawmakers in Washington, what you're proposing is just a bridge too far?
I would hope not. This is not an issue of immigration. This is not an issue of of trying to continue the ongoing immigration, quote unquote, ideological wars that are occurring. This is just an attempt for us to right a wrong. These men and women joined the military thinking that they would have the same protections as many other U.S. citizens. Many of them do not know that they're deportable when they sign their paperwork. Some of them, they don't have representation before they go through immigration court. And, what we're really trying to do is stop a serious wrong that we're doing on veterans that have, essentially sacrificed time, sweat, and blood for their country.
Congressman Ruben Gallego, Democrat from Arizona, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for your time.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Back to the story about undocumented veterans dealing with deportation. One of them is Daniel Torres, a former Marine from Mexico I profiled earlier this year on the show. He came to the U.S. as a kid and later enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps to give back to his new country. Torres served in Iraq but was discharged after it was discovered he used a fake birth certificate to enlist. I met him in Tijuana where he'd been stuck for 5 years, but since our meeting, his life has changed dramatically. Daniel Torres joins me now. So it's great to speak with you again. When I met you back in March in Tijuana, you were waiting to hear if you would be granted U.S. citizenship. Tell us what's happened since.
Well, I had my citizenship interview on the 21st of April, and I was granted citizenship. I took my oath, and I'm now a naturalized citizen.
Wow, congratulations. What was that moment like for you when you actually became a U.S. citizen?
It was kind of strange because it happened that same day, and it was really fast, and I wasn't really expecting it to be that fast. So it was a little bit surreal. I mean, I'm really, really happy and really, really excited.
So I want to ask you this, because on Memorial Day, as you know, the U.S. honors people who've given their lives while serving the United States. What are your thoughts this Memorial Day, now that you're a citizen, and given everything you've been through with the U.S. military?
It's a very special date for me, you know, because I've personally known guys who have died in combat. So it's really, you know, it's for me, it's a personal date. It really is. A lot of people, they don't realize what it takes to have a country like the United States, to have the freedoms that we enjoy. Most people take it for granted.
Daniel, you fought in Iraq. I'm just wondering if there's somebody your thoughts turn to on this Memorial Day, somebody who maybe you lost when you were enlisted.
Let me explain why Memorial Day is such an important date for me. I was a volunteer for Afghanistan, and before I was deployed to Afghanistan, it came to light that at the time I was undocumented, and so I was unable to deploy. However, the guy that replaced me, his name is Corporal Christopher Boyd. He took my spot on the Afghanistan deployment, and he was killed on 2010. So it's very, very personal for me, because I feel like that guy took my spot. He took my ticket.
Yeah, so has every Memorial Day been on your mind, even though you haven't been a citizen?
Of course it has. I used to say I might not be an American citizen, but I'm still a Marine. And I always had that pride in of being a Marine and celebrating those memorial services in remembrance of my brothers.
Daniel Torres, thanks so much for speaking with us. Great to speak with you again, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Daniel Torres is an Iraq war veteran who just got his U.S. citizenship after 5 years in legal limbo in Mexico. By the way, as a new citizen, he hopes to vote in the presidential election for Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Miss Lonesome. I'll see you back in town.
Finally today, we're going to travel back in time. A man from New Zealand is our guide, and he's going to regale us with a song that feels like it was written long ago somewhere in the American West. That's what 25-year-old Marlon Williams would like you to think anyway. Williams is the singer-songwriter in question from New Zealand. He says the timelessness of his music is intentional.
The ability to time travel in any sense is a pretty wonderful thing. I really get off on sounding like I'm from somewhere else or from some other time. It's it's quite freeing for me.
And the beggar on the street.
People still like labels for the music they're hearing, and a lot of people say Marlon Williams' music is Americana, an acoustic mix of folk, country, blues, and early echoes of rock and roll. And that's a little odd when you remember that Williams is from New Zealand. Americana doesn't belong just to Americans, he told me. So I asked him, who does it belong to?
Everyone and no one, really. It's, you know, it's music and the way genres work. It's a very linear process. You know, it didn't start in America. It reach some sort of synthesis in America, but it continues to do that, and you know, it's hard to see it from the inside, but if you follow the arc of how music migrates and moves around, then it starts to look a whole lot more complicated and far spread from a bird's eye view.
For a New Zealander, what does Americana even mean?
I mean, my definition is sort of based around what are reviews, and I can't think about it any other way than to be informed by what reviewers call, you know, how they pick genres and the general public. You know, it's, there's got to be a dialogue of understanding when it comes to music appreciation and communications, but that's really the only purpose it has.
I also feel like when I listen to your music, I'm hearing a lot of memory. I know you now live in Australia, but I gather it was really important for you for your latest recording to go back to where you grew up in Lyttelton, New Zealand. Talk about that and why visiting home was so important.
I mean, I'd been in Melbourne about a year and a half by the time I wanted to go back into the studio. And I guess just for the album I wanted to make, I wanted to make a really disparate sounding, you know, in terms of genre and in direction. I wanted to go a few different places, but just keep, you know, my voice as the common thread through everything.
I lost my wife in 1989.
I knew Ben Edwards, the producer and engineer who worked on it, would be the man for that job, just because we've worked together for so many years. He understands, I guess, my philosophy around that kind of stuff. Yeah, so I think familiarity was really important to this album.
Marlon Williams, great to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I don't recall putting that picture on the wall. The one of mother and child at Easter time. I hear strange things creeping in the night. I have strange dreams in the bed where Lucy died.
Americana by way of New Zealand wraps things up today. Zealand Anna just doesn't have the same ring to it. By the way, Marlon Williams' videos really stand out. They're dramatic short films, really, and they tell some pretty compelling but dark stories. We've got a few of them up at PRI.org. Check them out. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. From all of us here at The World, have a peaceful Memorial Day.
They all went back to the city. I've never seen a living soul. I buried down beneath the garden that Lucy proudly grew, the whitest rose that ever was in bloom. I hear strange things creeping in the night. I have strange dreams.
PRI, Public Radio International.